Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Cole and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Kowal. Both Jeff and I are certified appellate specialists, and as uncertified podcast hosts, we try to bring our audience of trial and appellate attorneys some legal news and perspectives they can use in their practice. Please recommend this to a colleague if you find it useful.
Yeah, and if you don't like it, please forward the podcast to your opposing counsel.
All right, Jeff, you've been telling me to get a new gag, but you need a new gag and follow-up. Today, Jeff, you know, we got the chance to see each other last week in person when we visited the Orange County Bar Association's Appellate Section annual meeting, Ask Us Anything, where they bring in several research attorneys from the Courts of Appeal, and we get to ask them almost anything about what kind of pet peeves do you have when reading briefs? What are some of the most common trap doors that attorneys fall into? What are some of the biggest briefing mistakes? How do we make our briefs more successful and persuasive on appeal? And we got some great tips, Jeff. I saw you writing down furiously. I took some notes myself, and you came up with a top 10 list that I thought would be good that we cover today.
Yeah, and by the way, this is not the official position of the court. It's not even the official position of any particular division. Sometimes opinions can differ, but what I gathered was from when these judicial lawyers or just judicial attorneys were willing to offer these tips, this is generally the consensus of most justices and most judicial attorneys in the two courts we were dealing with in the Orange County 4th Appellate District, including Riverside and San Diego, and the 2nd District up in LA. So, and let me also say, kind of the theme of all these top 10 tips that I gathered is when you give a brief to an appellate justice or an appellate attorney, you're building trust or losing trust with doing certain things. And every time you do things, let's say following the tips on this list, you build trust. And every time you depart from this list or do bad things, you can lose trust. And they use that phrase over and over and over again in terms of credibility, whether they just put your brief down and read the other side's brief when they want to learn something if you lose credibility, or if they trust that when you cite to a case, it says what you think, what you say it says.
Yeah, I noted that theme as well, building trust. Keep making deposits in the trustworthiness bank and make as few withdrawals as possible. It's kind of like having a good investment strategy. Always keep moving forward. Always be depositing more than you're withdrawing. So let's get right into the tips, Jeff. Here are some of the helpful tips that were offered by various research attorneys from all three divisions of the 4th District and one of the divisions of the 2nd District. So tip number one, briefs that include hyperlinks to the record are permissible, and they're encouraged, even though they're relatively rare. This is the one tip, Jeff, that I found surprising, pleasantly surprising, because you and I are big advocates of clear brief. We use clear briefs for preparing our briefs with hyperlink citations to the record. And the last time I had asked a research attorney about whether they are opening links in hyperlinks in briefs, they said, no, it's a security issue. And that was, I think, maybe it was one or 2 years ago. But that's a shift now, because all of the research attorneys we asked are now supportive of hyperlinks to the site, to record citations.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And they didn't mention it, but I'll just appellate attorneys did not mention this at the presentation, but I'm just going to do another quick plug for our friends at Clear Brief. That's the product I use to hyperlink the record and case citations. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I use it for everything. I use it not only for briefs, but for memos internally, for documents that I send to the client so they can see what I'm talking about when I say that here's your great evidence, here's the evidence that's not so good for you, and they can see it without having to include a bunch of messy attachments and things like that, direct them to page and line numbers. Clear Brief does that instantly, and it really validates or furthers the principle of show, don't tell. In that we always talk about when you're drafting your appellate briefs, you want to show what you're talking about, not give your conclusions, not use adjectives, just say what the facts are. And then if you include a hyperlink that sends the reader directly there, that is what they're used for. That's what Clear Brief is used for. So one of the quotes that I wrote down about using those hyperlinks is that they're incredibly effective, but very rarely used.
Yeah. Yeah. For more than just one of the attorneys, there was kind of shaking of a head like, yeah, they're great, but we don't really see them.
Yeah. And again, another comment was that they help build trust because they'll read attorneys, sometimes they'll say any old thing. And if there's not a citation to it, it's not worth anything. Even if there is a citation to it, if it's, you don't always want to stop what you're doing and open another document and go pull it up. It reminds me of the priceless marketing advice I got from my coach, Gary Johnson, that you should never put your links in LinkedIn posts. Did you know this, Jeff, that if you put a hyperlink in your LinkedIn post, it encourages the reader to click away and go to a different website. And then you've lost your attention and you've lost, LinkedIn has lost a visitor to its site and it wants to keep eyeballs in your site. And as the attorney, you want to keep your eyeballs in your brief. You don't want them opening up other briefs and checking out your sources. You want them opening your link in ClearBrief so it's side by side. You've got the source side by side with your brief talking about the source. So it keeps visitors in your train of thought and in your brief. Okay, tip number two. The first paragraph of the introduction should describe the order or judgment being appealed and include an accurate citation to the record. This one was, it seemed obvious, Jeff, but all of the research attorneys chimed in on this and said, yeah, we are a court of review. We want to know right up front, what the heck are we reviewing? We don't have to wait until, the statement of appealability to find out what order or judgment we're supposed to be looking at.
Yeah, I think my opening sentence in the opening paragraph of just about every brief I do on appeal is, this is an appeal from an order denying an anti-SLAPP, or this is an appeal from a support order in a family law case, something like that, so that the justices in the first 5 minutes can decide which clerk they should go to or how urgent it is, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's also has the benefit of getting you over your writer's block. If you don't know how to open a brief, you should probably always just start with, this is an appeal from, and cite the name and the date of the order or judgment you're appealing from. And then you're done. You've got your opening for your opening brief.
Yeah. Let me, on a side point, I'm going to diverge from our top 10 list here for a second. I was surprised that the representative from the 4th Appellate District, Division 2, which is out in Riverside, San Bernardino, was asked a question, do you put citations in your introduction? And all of them said, for this purpose, citing to the order that's under review, it's super important to have a citation early on so that the justices or the attorneys can quickly find the order being reviewed. But most of them said, in terms of citations in that introductory paragraph, you don't really need citations. Unless there's a big, big case, there's one dispositive case, maybe cite that, but you don't really need citations. And I found that surprising because once in my career, I had one of my briefs stricken. It was a respondent's brief. And it was stricken by the 4th Appellate District Division 2. Wow. And the reason it was stricken is my improper opponent pointed out that my introductory paragraph, my summary of argument, did not contain citations to the record. So I was, ever since then, I've always been leery of not including citations to the record in that opening paragraph, even though all the attorneys there said, yeah, you don't have to.
That's a shocking result. I had heard the same comment that this research attorney gave by Justice Bedsworth himself years ago at another bar event. Someone asked him the same question. Do we need to put citations in the introduction? He said, no, it's just to give us a flavor for what the case is about. It doesn't need to be, a statement of facts or a legal brief with citations to legal authority. So no, that's the exception from the rest of the brief where you should have citations. That's shocking that not only that they would strike a brief that failed to have citations in the introduction, but they'd strike a respondent's brief, which is supposed to be a helper brief anyway. You can't, there's no benefit to the court from striking the respondent's brief other than it deprives them of a resource that they can use to evaluate the legitimacy of the claims and, the legal and factual claims in the opening brief.
But by the way, for the record, I won that appeal.
They didn't need it. They were already confident in your arguments. Well, so what is your takeaway? After you had all of the research attorneys there last week telling you, nah, you don't need cites in your introduction.
If it's a broad kind of summary of argument, like the anti-SLAPP motion should have been denied because, fact A, fact B, fact C, that kind of broadish argument, I don't include citations. But if there's a very specific thing or if I'm quoting, I I'm a little gun shy now, and I put in the citations, which I hate because it breaks up the reading. They're like little speed bumps for your eyeballs. But I tend to include them now. I'm gun shy.
Yeah, and one tip along that line that they gave is if you are, it would be helpful to cite the judgment or order that you're appealing from, so that the reader can get to that instantly. Because again, they're very interested to know, what am I reviewing? So if you can send them right to that, and maybe that helps. If that's the one and only thing that you're including a citation to in your introduction, it underscores the importance that here's the document that this whole appeal is about.
Yeah, or maybe the pessimist in me thinks they want the quick cite to that, so they can pull it up and see, is this an appealable, reviewable order? Or can they quickly assess if it's a timely notice of appeal and that kind of thing? But yeah, that's pessimist to me.
Yeah. Okay. Tip number three from the research attorneys from the Court of Appeal. A table of contents is often the first thing that a justice or a judicial attorney looks at, and it should tell the story. That means use complete sentences in your headers.
Yeah. Compelling sentences, right? So when you read the table of contents, I tell associates and staff at my firm, pretend like the justices are not going to read your brief. And on the day of oral argument, they're going to pick up the brief and just look at the table of contents when they walk into oral argument. They should be able to know what every argument is and why we should win. So you shouldn't have the anti-slap order should be reversed. It should be the order denying the anti-slap motion should be reversed because this was not a case of public interest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good... That's a good way of thinking about it. You could also think about it in terms of pretend that you're going into oral argument and you want an outline, and that table of contents could be your outline for oral argument.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, let me say this on a related point, a related question. You know, we were ending the time. The lunch was over. People were getting ready to leave. I don't want to be that guy that raises their hand to ask another question when everybody wanted to hit the road. But another question I had was, so if you're the appellant, you've got your headings. And then the respondent does their brief, and sometimes the headings don't match yours. When you do the reply brief, Tim, do you have your headings kind of match what you did in your original opening brief, or do you have your headings kind of track the arguments presented in the respondent's brief?
I don't necessarily track the same structure from my opening brief. I like to hone in on the key points, and maybe depending on what was addressed in the respondent's brief, if something comes out as whatever I think at that point is going to be highest on the justices' minds, I want to address those in that order.
I have to tell you, sometimes I forget, and I think it's worthwhile to point out when the other side fails to respond to an argument. So if you have an opening brief with an argument that says, you know, prong one was not met because of reason A, and the response brief just blows past it, doesn't respond to it. When you're drafting your reply, because they haven't responded to it, you might not mention that failure to respond, and it's possible justice might not pick up on it. So for that reason alone, I think it's helpful to have at least a reference to the original heading in your opening brief and just a short argument saying, in the opening brief, we raised this issue. Other side did not address it and cite the case that says sometimes failing to address an issue is a concession of its merits.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that approach. Yeah. If you got a key argument that you raised in your opening brief and that was not meaningfully addressed or not addressed at all in the respondent's brief, then yeah, I want to bring that up front and center, that here's the core issue in this appeal and respondents have nothing to say to it. And then maybe, say something more, a little something more if you that maybe, you know, another gloss on it that you hadn't put in your opening brief, and then just leave it, leave well enough alone. Let their silence be deafening.
Yeah.
Another point about the table of contents is that one of the comments that we got from the research attorneys is that the justices often, you know, they're just like any other reader. They're going to make an assessment fairly quickly about your case. They're not going to make up their mind completely, but they're going to get a sense of which way they're headed, and it's going to be fairly quickly. So a mind can reserve judgment for only so long, and the longer it takes you to bring the goods, the more likely it is that the reader is going to, you know, start concluding that you ain't got them. So, get to the point quickly. Don't hem and haw and do a lot of throat clearing. You know, don't wait till the legal discussion section of your brief to get to the meat. Put that right in the introduction and put a nice roadmap in your table of contents by using good organized headings.
Yeah.
With complete sentences.
Yeah.
Okay, number four, Jeff. This is a perennial tip that we talk about on this podcast. Avoid acronyms and jargon. Pretty much unanimous among the research attorneys that they all hate acronyms.
Yeah. So, I'll use terms like the bank or the distributor or the manufacturer, as opposed to, you know, crazy abbreviations or shorthand references. I do that. And another thing I learned, not from this presentation, but a second district presentation, sometimes it drives the courts bananas when you define terms that don't need defining. So if you're suing Apple Computer and, you use the term Apple, everybody knows who you're talking about. You don't have to do, open parens here and after, quote, Apple, close parens. That's just unnecessary stupidity.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Jeff, but ever since I think Justice Kagan kind of showed the way on that a couple of years ago, there was an opinion involving Ford Motor Company, and She didn't define Ford. She just went ahead saying the word Ford afterward as if we all knew what she was talking about. And everyone said, no one has any doubt what she's talking about. And ever since then, I thought, I'm going to drop those paren quotation mark with the definition in there, unless there's some really compelling reason to do so. I've just dropped them.
Yeah. I'll say this, though, Tim. I've always struggled with it at the trial court level. In your notice of motion, if you define terms, there's certain terms that are not commonly known, and you define parties in certain ways. And then you have you do your notice, and then you have your table of contents and your table of authorities, and then you jump into your motion. And I wonder, at that point, do you have to redefine a second time those terms that you defined in the notice? Is it possible that the judge has skipped over your notice and went right to your brief? I never know what to do there. What do you do?
That's a good question. I've struggled with the same thing about defining the terms in the notice. I thought about maybe I won't define them in the notice. I'll just repeat them again when I get to the brief and then define them for the first time there. Or I think usually I probably will just rely on the definitions that I've given in the notice, and hopefully they're clear enough. That's a good reason not to use acronyms. Anything that is readily intelligible, I think you won't get in trouble with.
Yeah. 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 I think that's a good point.
So if you can use, it doesn't have to be shortened, completely. I think that's why people like acronyms is that, now it's only three letters. So it's so much more efficient. But if you use a meaningful name, yes, it has a few more syllables, but it has more meaning for the reader.
Yeah. Look, my rule of thumb is I try to use terms that if I were at oral argument, whether it's trial level or a court of appeal, that it will easily come out of my lips, that I won't stumble over. As if I was telling the story or describing to a family member, I filed a lawsuit against the manufacturer because of problems.
Yeah. So I involved in this lawsuit and JCW interviewed deposed XYZ, and you wouldn't believe what XYZ said. You're like, what are you talking about? Can you speak English?
Right.
It reminds me that that language, the written language came after the spoken language. So to your point about, think about how you would say it out loud and then write like that. So maybe think about how you're going to talk about these parties at oral argument and use the same language in your brief. That way you're not having to make translations that when you're at oral argument. Now, Your Honor, I'm going to be representing the party that I referred to in the briefs as JCW, but I'm going to refer to him now as John.
Right.
Okay, next tip, number five, if you have bad facts, disclose them, be upfront with them, deal with them like an adult. Don't try to hide it because they will find it anyway. And hiding or ignoring bad facts, to get back to the theme, the recurring theme, it depletes trust in your arguments and in your presentation. So be upfront because they're going to find them anyway.
Yeah. And on the subject of trust, these attorneys, they mentioned trust in terms of one singular brief, one singular case, but they didn't say this, but I suspect these attorneys and justices, remember names of lawyers that commonly appear in their court. And I bet losing trust can carry over from one case to the other. And so can building trust, I suspect.
Yeah, that's right. So be upfront with the bad facts. Same thing with the other side's good arguments. If the other side has a good argument, consider maybe addressing it before they even get around to it. There's not a rule. You have to use discretion on these things, but let's see. Number six, tip number six, every section of your appellate brief should have a purpose. What did the research attorneys mean by that, Jeff, that every section should have its own purpose?
This is something I learned new for the first time. I hadn't really thought of this issue this way, but they basically said, you know, an introduction should be an introduction that concisely summarizes all the issues, but you don't put your entire legal argument in the introduction with every case. You save that for the argument. And similarly, the statements of fact should neutrally state all the facts and all the relevant facts and try to avoid argument. And because the purpose of the facts section is to present facts. And similarly, when you get to the argument section, you shouldn't use that as an opportunity to introduce new facts that weren't discussed in the statement of facts. If it's an important enough fact to include in your argument section, it should appear in the statement of facts. So it was a good lesson to kind of focus in when you're writing a brief. What section am I working on? Is it the argument? Is it the statement of facts? Or is it the introduction? And remember its purpose.
Yeah, that's right. Your statement of facts should be putting gas in the tank for all of your arguments. So, you know, all the facts, all the evidence that you're going to be relying on to make your arguments, you should be teeing those up in your statement of facts. I think one of the research attorneys mentioned that if you have one kind of tangential argument whose underlying facts don't really fit into the rest of the case narrative, that could be an exception. So it's not completely black and white, but the good rule of thumb is to put all of your facts into the statement of facts and, you know, treat each section as its own in its own purpose. And again, that purpose of the statement of facts is not to be you're always an advocate. You're always advocating and pressing your case, but you're doing it in a different way. You're not doing it in an argumentative style in your statement of facts, but you are, you know, putting emphasis on if you're making a procedural issue that, you know, raising a procedural issue that the judge, you know, failed to should have bifurcated issues or something like that, then you get really fact heavy with all the facts that show the importance of having this issue tried first and how lumping it in with the other arguments would lead to a distorted view of the case. You know, whatever it is, you want to lean that way, but you do it all with factual statements, not advocate statements.
Yeah, and look, if you're desperate to insert a zinger, if you really want to raise attention to a certain fact and how it relates to an argument, you could drop a footnote and put the argument in a footnote in the statement of facts section. But yeah.
Leave the argument out. That way the reader's free to ignore it.
Yeah.
Okay, tip number 7, for emergency writs, while establishing error is important, the judicial attorneys and the justices also look for sufficient development of the argument about exigency or public policy. So don't overdo the former and don't ignore the latter. What did the research attorneys mean by that, Jeff?
I was surprised to hear them say that most attorneys do a pretty good job of establishing the error, but then they kind of skip over the emergency. Why should this, similar to ex partes at the trial court level, why should this emergency writ at the appellate level skip the line and be decided before all the other cases on the docket? Where's the fire?
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of the Court of Appeal is looking at your writ petitions and saying, it seems like you have a pretty good argument for your appeal. Why do we have to hear this as a writ?
Right.
So don't just stop at the judge did a very bad thing. You have to explain how it's going to cause a very bad result before you get a chance to get a result on an appeal. All right, number 8, here's another perennial tip. Avoid the passive voice. Be direct, be authentic in how you present things. Don't try to, I don't know how we learn, but we all learn how to write in the passive voice. Maybe it sounds less, like you can get less trouble somehow, or it sounds harmless.
It could be, you know, as young lawyers, you read other lawyers' briefs. And other people write in the passive voice, and you just in your head you think about what sounds lawyerly and what sounds like things you've read, and I think it's a self-perpetuating problem with other people in the profession.
Yeah.
You know, my number one tool for destroying passive voice is brief catch. I use brief catch on my briefs, and it usually catches all of my passive voice issues.
Yeah, that's a good tool to use. I also use brief catch. Maybe another temptation for using passive voice is that there's less information in a passive sentence because it describes the action, but it omits the actor. And maybe you're not sure who the actor was, or you're not, you haven't thought through whether it's relevant. Sometimes it's not relevant. And so sometimes, you know, that's why passive voice is not always the wrong choice, but usually you do want the actor in there. And if you have to talk about the action, and then later on, at some point, you're going to talk about who the actor was, why don't you put it in one sentence? That's a way to be more effective and direct in your writing.
Yeah.
Okay, number nine, we're getting down to the end here, Jeff. Check your citations for accuracy. It seems obvious, yeah. But the attorneys really seem to be bothered by the inaccurate citations.
Yeah, and this was more than just the case says what you say it says, or the record says what you say it is. It is, you click on the link or you go to that page and it's the wrong page. And they say they understand that typos happen, but when a brief is replete with citations that don't match the actual record, it's a headache.
Yeah. And again, it's it depletes your trust because if they want to check out what you said in your brief and it's not supported at the site that you gave, then all of a sudden they start to wonder, what about all their other statements in the brief? Are any of them supported? So, yeah, it's hard to get 100% accuracy. But, you know, again, using a tool like BriefCatch can help you do that, because as you're briefing, you can see your citation right there, and you can always go right back and check very easily without taking you out of your flow. All right, tip number 10, if you have an index, such as an index in the appendix, consider hyperlinking the name of the document to the relevant page. What does this mean, Jeff?
Well, look, most of the time, 99% of the appeals I handle, I do an appellate's appendix rather than a clerk's transcript. And, you know, these are in PDF format. And if it's a multi-volume appeal with different files, it can be a bit of a headache to go back and forth trying to figure out where in the record this particular page is. So this was one of the attorneys present for this panel who said, if you hyperlink the name of the document in the index, it takes you right to the relevant document. It saves the attorney time when they're looking for a document. So not when they're in your brief checking your citation, but when the attorney is thinking to themselves, self, I want to see the closing brief on this issue. They can go to the index, look up closing brief and click on that on the name, and it'll take them right to the right page in the record.
Yeah. Yeah. And that reminds me of another tip that you told me about years ago about that if there is a key document that you really want the court to look at, you can put that, you can attach it to the end of your brief. And it's a little known and little used tip, but in the right case, it can be very effective.
I think it can be really effective, and it's rarely used. And I got to tell you, I was surprised by the yawns and the looks of indifference that I got from these attorneys when I raised this. You know, is this practice of attaching 10 pages, is it helpful? Is it useful? And I got a, yeah, you can do it kind of a response.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're using ClearBrief like you and I do, and now that I know that the justices and research attorneys are in fact clicking on them, that may be less needed or less useful than it used to be, because you can send them right to any portion of the record. But especially if you're not using the hyperlinks in your brief, and you want the judge to see, you know, the order that you're appealing from or your smoking gun document, you can just attach that right to the back of your brief, yeah. And they don't have to go hunting around for it.
Yeah. Or an unusual case or regulation, or maybe an out-of-state case. It doesn't always have to be evidence. It could be helpful authority.
Yeah. And to underscore how how rarely it is used, remember the first time I tried to do it, it was kicked by the filing clerk and said, what is this at the back of your brief? And I had to email the clerk back and cite the rule that says I can do this. And the clerk went back and checked with the head clerk and said, oh, okay, I guess you can do it.
Let me guess, Orange County?
It was Orange County, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, hopefully these tips were effective, but are useful to our listeners. But again, I think your takeaway of the recurring theme, Jeff, is accurate, that it's all about building trust. You want to be, as the appellate attorney, you want to be a helper to the court. You can't knock them over the head, you know, to make them accept your argument. You have to lead them there, and to do that, they have to find you trustworthy if they're going to follow you.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that theme, one more bonus tip that was not presented at this presentation, wasn't discussed by these attorneys, but on the subject of gaining or losing credibility with the court, I think we mentioned on an earlier episode that Justice Bedsworth is retiring from the 4th Appellate District Division 3. He's not retiring quietly. He is speaking his mind. And on May 2nd, decision was published by the 4th Appellate Division 3, Massimo Corporation versus the Vanderpool Law Firm. And this was an issue involving discovery sanctions. $10,000 in discovery sanctions was issued. And one of the arguments raised on appeal was maybe there hadn't been an adequate meet and confer below, and so sanctions were not appropriate. And Justice Bedsworth took that opportunity to say, well, maybe some of the things that were said by trial counsel were not appropriate in terms of the meet and confer. And he went on to say, look, appellate attorneys, we've tried to warn you. We've tried to be subtle. From this point forward, if we see bad actions, incivility, unprofessionalism below, in the record below, we may take the opportunity to point it out and quote from it liberally and put it on the pages of a published decision. So mind your manners. And I'm going to read one of the money quotes here by Justice Bedsworth. He says, civility is not about etiquette. This is not a matter of bad manners. Incivility slows things down. It costs people money. Money they were counting on their lawyers to help them save, and it contravenes the legislature's directive that all parties cooperate in bringing the action to trial. Incivility is the adult equivalent of schoolyard bullying, and we will not keep looking the other way when attorneys practice like this. They will be called out and immortalized in the California appellate reports.
Well, so not only sanctions, but immortality. Ignominy in these decisions. Was this a published decision?
It was published, and yeah, let me the one email that stands out that was published in terms of this decision was one lawyer said to another lawyer. The email began with the subject line, "You are joking, right?" And the body of the email continued, "In 30 years of practice, this may be the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Robert, is this really why you went to law school?" And then it goes on. Justice Bedsworth seems to think that might be incivil.
Yeah. It's obviously incivil. You would like to think that most of us don't practice that way, but tempers get hot in litigation, and especially in discovery. And
when you're dealing with sanctions and sanctioning a lawyer as opposed to a party, yeah, things get heated. And that's why, you know, you can draft an email, an angry email, and save it. And don't hit send. And then the next morning, maybe after you feel better having written it, you can revise it, tone it down, and then send it.
Yeah. I wonder if there needs to be a. I know that in my day in law school, I remember hearing about there had been a steady drumbeat that had been repelled for a lot of years about, isn't the third year of law school kind of just fluff? You don't really need the courses in the third year. It's just kind of pre-bar prep. As long as we're keeping that third year with a lot of elective type classes, maybe we should add one more mandatory class about civility in the profession, kind of a professional responsibility part two, and include this Massimo case. And there was another case like it a couple of years ago that talked about how incivility costs the client and it costs the courts because we have all these additional discovery motions and discovery that should be wrapped up fairly quickly. It drags on and on because of the incivility and the foot dragging.
Yeah. In fact, the Bedsworth cited that case. It was the Carton case, K-A-R-T-O-N, from 2021. And it has one of my favorite quotes saying, excellent lawyers deserve higher fees, and excellent lawyers are civil. And then it used that as a way of upholding a severe reduction in an attorney fee award because the lawyer in that case was not excellent and was not civil.
Yeah, but this is the right approach. I mean, that Carton case tethered the attorney's recovery to the attorney's ability to be civil throughout the case, and if that that positive economic incentive is not enough, then now your name is going to be put in bright lights in published decisions about how incivil you are.
Yeah, it's like from Game of Thrones, shame, you know, being shamed in the public square.
Yeah. All right. So this is the bonus tip. Be civil. I guess it's the Bill and Ted's tip. Be excellent to each other. But it's not only Not only good practice of law, not only will it get you greater attorney's fees awards, but it'll keep your name out of the spotlight from being shamed in the Court of Appeal, which at least Justice Bedsworth has indicated is going to happen. And they're going to continue shining that spotlight whenever they see these acts of incivility. And at a minimum, Jeff, if you're going to be incivil, don't do it in an email.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Pick up the phone. Even if you intend to be incivil when you pick up the phone, hopefully just the fact of speaking with another human being rather than just being in your own isolated echo chamber, pecking out an email with no filter, you know, picking that phone will create its own filter.
Yeah. I'll go one step further, you know, set up a Zoom, because when you're looking at your opponent in the eye and you can see they're a living, breathing human being,
yeah, they
might have their own issues and their own concerns. It's a good way to de-escalate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that wraps us up today. If you have suggestions for future episodes, please email us at info@calpodcast.com. And in our upcoming episodes, look for more tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again